Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Lurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. In less than a month, the anniversary of September 11 will be marked with an outpouring of sorrow, patriotism, and remembrance here in the United States. But there are other goings-on around the world which have resulted in much more grief and are not generally well reported by the American news business. Today, we're going to talk about Africa. We will discuss hunger on a continent where millions of people are malnourished. We will discuss health problems in countries where millions suffer from HIV and AIDS. We will discuss what appears to be growing racism by black leaders in a country, Zimbabwe, that was for years a white colony. We will talk about growing anti-Americanism among those who take umbrage at the dominant American role in the world, mostly in North Africa. Our guests for this discussion are Penny Dale, British broadcasting correspondent in Lusaka, Zambia; Martin Plout, Africa editor of the BBC in London; Philip Smucker, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and the London Daily Telegraph in Cairo; and Rachel Swarns, Southern Africa bureau chief of the New York Times in Johannesburg, South Africa. Welcome to all of you. Let's start by asking Rachel Swarns, what is the most serious problem in Southern Africa these days? Is it hunger, health, or the hunkering down of longtime political leaders who are giving short change to democracy?
I think that there's no doubt that the AIDS epidemic is the most serious problem facing Southern Africa today. The hunger situation is worsened by the AIDS epidemic, but it's a devastating epidemic here, and we're in the region that's worst affected. South Africa has the largest number of people infected with HIV in the world, and most of the neighboring countries have enormous percentages of adults infected with HIV/AIDS. So we have Botswana with nearly 40%, Zimbabwe with almost 35%. So it's devastating.
It's just incredible, and yet the stories that we read say that Southern Africa is in denial, and it itself refuses to realize the seriousness of the situation.
Actually, you know, it varies quite a bit. There are certainly members of South Africa's government who have been in denial about the epidemic, and unfortunately, President Thabo Mbeki has not been a leader in this regard. He has been questioning whether HIV causes AIDS, questioning the safety of anti-AIDS drugs, which obviously are powerful drugs, and you wouldn't want to take them if you were healthy, but save many lives. But on the other hand, you have someone like President Festus Mahai of Botswana, where he's taking an extraordinary role in combating the epidemic, and Botswana is the first country, I believe, in sub-Saharan Africa where they have committed themselves to treating everyone who is HIV positive. So it really does vary.
Let's bring Penny Dale into this discussion. Penny, in Zambia, I take it starvation is a bigger problem than in South Africa. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. There are about, out of Zambia's population of 10 million people, about 3 million people are in great need of food, immediate food relief. What's happened in Zambia is that for the last 2 years have been, this year there was a great drought that hit the food producing areas, and the previous year there were floods, so the crop was wiped out, and Zambia is not able to feed itself.
These are just incredible numbers that both of you are giving us on the AIDS problem and the starvation problem. Martin Plout, in London, why is it that the Western world, the developed world, does not pay more attention to these stories?
Well, I think that it does. It's a question of who in the Western world you're talking about. I think that there has been a good response, for example, amongst ordinary people in Britain who've raised over £5 million, that's about $7-8 million, for this. But if you talk about governments, then the answer is poor. You take the Netherlands has raised about $500,000, Sweden's raised very little, Japan's raised nothing at all, to major appeals from the United Nations. So there is something of a fatigue on the part of governments, but I don't sense it on the part of ordinary people. They are connected with these kind of demands and these kind of requests that are coming in.
Right, but unfortunately, ordinary people cannot really do a lot by themselves. £5 million is a lot of money to come from ordinary people, but still, considering these problems, it's a drop in the bucket.
It is, but on the other hand, you know, the people like the Mormons, for example, have put up $1 million from America. So, I mean, you know, the World Food Program, which has launched this huge appeal for $500 million, is seeking alternative forms of funding. And that's very important because it gives a greater boost to government efforts, but it also provides an alternative. And one of the big issues that now is facing Southern Africa is not just drought and the need for aid, but also the whole question of genetically modified crops, because you in America may be perfectly happy to have GM food on your table, but in Europe we're not. And there's a concern now in Southern Africa if they allow American maize to be produced and brought into Southern Africa, that they won't be able to then export ever again to Europe. So that is a big blow at the moment, and it's a huge controversy in Southern Africa.
This is another problem that I think we have to talk about a little bit, and that is growing questioning of American policies in almost every respect, whether they're political or military or social or whatever. Do you sense that from London?
I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, I came back this year. I've been in a number of countries, including Pakistan and in Israel. And wherever one goes, people question the American perspective on things. They feel that for good reason or ill, that they're not being well served by the United States. At the same time, one shouldn't overestimate this. There's a huge admiration for American democracy that is still there. Although there's an anger that America doesn't take the alternative perspectives as seriously as they should, nonetheless, people admire the United States for its democratic credentials and also, of course, for its huge economic success. But the problem is it's a two-edged sword. The more powerful you are, the more people turn around and say, well, you know, these people are pushing us around, and that's a problem.
Yeah, Philip Smucker, I think there are grave problems with anti-Americanism in Egypt these days.
Well, in fact, yes, it's growing basically across North Africa. You know, extending over into the Middle East, but in North Africa, you have people looking at the Bush administration policies and thinking first of Palestine, watching on their TV screens every day the violence, which is often should be said from an Arab perspective. The pictures that are shown are mainly, you know, Palestinians being brutalized. So when the U.S. now calls for a war on Iraq, there's very little support, and people think, well, maybe the Bush administration is going to attack more Arabs in another country, and we'll see more pictures like this. So they want this Palestinian problem solved first, and after that, I think they'd be willing to listen to other ideas on the war on terror.
I think the United States would like to see the Palestinian problem solved pretty quickly also. But it seems that there are practically irreconcilable differences. Who wants to deal with that? Martin?
Well, I think that is certainly true. I mean, the Middle East has been in turmoil ever since the Second World War, and perhaps even before that. I mean, the British had a hard enough time trying to deal with it when it's Palestine. But perhaps I can ask Rachel a question. In Johannesburg, the Earth Summit opens in Johannesburg at the end of this month. Is President Bush, do you think he's going to be there? Because, I mean, if he isn't, it's going to be a huge blow to American prestige in the whole continent.
You know, there's been no official announcement, but we think that he's not. It looks like the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, will attend. But it looks pretty clear that, that President Bush is not going to attend. I think part of that is that there has been a bit of disengagement under the Bush administration from, you know, Kyoto and other kind of world agreements on the environment. And I think, frankly, it may not be that important a conference in terms of how the United States views this. I think also there is the expectation that there will be a lot of criticism, which I'm sure there will be, of the United States in this event. I think people are hoping that with Colin Powell coming, and he does have some standing, even in places where there is more criticism of Bush, that some of that may not be as strong as it might have been. But there's no doubt that there will be a lot of disappointment. So I don't think many people will be surprised that Bush doesn't come.
Penny Dale, if I may bring you back into the discussion, can you talk a little bit about Zimbabwe and the situation there as far as AIDS, hunger, and political leadership is concerned?
Yeah, well, Zimbabwe has been hit most badly by the hunger situation in southern Africa. I mean, about half of the population are in great need of food assistance. And, you know, the reasons why is partly because of Mugabe's controversial land reform. I think no one can say that there isn't a need for land reform in Zimbabwe. I think we're all clear about that now. But the way he's done it, I mean, for years he wasn't able to do anything about it under the terms of the independence agreement. But when he did have the opportunity, he didn't want to do anything about it. And then he sees what he's done basically is he's given over land to peasants who need it, peasant farmers who need it, but haven't then given them the assistance they need, like, for instance, the tools to clear the land and markets for their produce and so on. So this has led to a drop in food production. And that has impacted on the rest of the region because Zimbabwe was an exporter of maize.
Penny and Rachel, there have been stories indicating that the Mugabe government is actually withholding food from Zimbabweans who voted against Mugabe in the recent election. Is that correct?
There have been, I was in Zimbabwe, I guess, 2 weeks ago, and the head of one of the senior officials from the U.S. Agency for Development was there. And there certainly have, the sense from American officials was that there certainly were cases of this. And the question is how widespread it is and how directed it is from the top. You know, what has happened in Zimbabwe now is that there are many supporters of the president who are not kind of part of, you know, official structures who have a great deal of power on their own and sometimes just kind of do things. And so there's a question of whether or not it's being directly orchestrated or whether it's not, whether it's people acting on their own. But it does seem like cases like this have been verified.
Okay, we have to take a break. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or here in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. Robert Mugabe gets all of the attention in the press, particularly in the United States these days, as an African leader who is trampling on democracy. But what about the situation elsewhere in Africa? Penny, what is the situation in Zambia?
Well, officially, Zambia is a multi-party democracy and has been so for the past 10 years. There's been a change of government this year. President Levimwana Wasa came into power in January, and it's been interesting times ever since because there have been lots and lots of allegations that the former regime, which was headed by Frederick Chiluba, was totally corrupt. And so at the moment, we're seeing a legal battle between ex-President Chiluba and the parliament, which actually tried to lift Chiluba's immunity from prosecuting so that he can face these corruption charges. And, you know, in my opinion, corruption and democracy are linked. And, you know, if you're squandering the resources of the country, then you're not really being a democratic leader.
Excuse me.
So it's interesting to see.
Yeah, you say corruption and democracy are linked, but I assume you mean corruption and a less than perfect democracy or a lack of democracy. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if leaders are plundering the state's resources, mm-hmm. then they're denying their people their social and economic rights, and surely that's all part of democracy.
Right. Martin, you oversee African coverage from London. What is the situation in other countries in Africa? Is there anything as serious as the situation in Zimbabwe on the screen?
Well, sadly, there are many countries which are at least as serious as Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe just gets a lot of coverage because it has some whites who are having a hard time. And I mean, I think it's right that they are, that it is given the coverage. But I think there's one thing that is worth pointing out is that in some areas of Africa, certainly there are glimmers of hope. If you take the situation in Congo, there's been an agreement for troops to be pulled out by a number of countries, and that's looking much more optimistic. And in Angola, the war has come to an end. Jonas Savimbi's death has brought that about. In Burundi, there are now talks which are beginning in Tanzania to try and get an end to a ceasefire there. In Sierra Leone, the war has come to an end, largely, I might say, because British troops went in and made it possible. And in Sudan, there are now talks to try and end a war that's gone on for 30 years and left 2 million people dead. So there are some signs of hope. The problem is really that, these are small signs. There are plenty of problems around. And the real question is, does the United Nations have enough in terms of finances, in terms of troops, to really bolster this effort? And here the United States is absolutely crucial. You're the largest provider of funding to the United Nations. And if you disengage, then there'll be a real problem for Africa.
Philip Smucker, do you want to make any comments about that?
Yeah, well, let's not leave out this this ongoing case here in Egypt of the human rights activist Saeed Eddine Ibrahim, whose conviction on very scant evidence has put him in jail for 7 years. He's an old guy, 63 years old. His citizenship is also American. The Bush administration leaked a story to the Washington Post, which is on the front page today, that says the Bush administration changing its policy in a rather abrupt way is going to freeze all future aid to Egypt because it sees this as an attack on civil society in Egypt. Of course, there have been a lot of attacks over the years, in the last 20 years, on civil society in Egypt, particularly groups that are not allowed to meet or organize. So there could be a shift here, a subtle shift in North Africa.
Martin,
I just wanted to...
Go ahead, Rachel. Or Penny.
No, sorry, Penny.
No,
I just wanted to come back to Martin's point about glimmer of hope and so on. One of the fantastic things here in Zambia has been the role of civil society. 10 years ago, hardly anybody would speak out. And last year, we saw Frederick Chiluba trying to push for a third term, which is not allowed under the Constitution. And it wasn't the politicians that stopped him. It was, in fact, civil society. I mean, people people organized themselves and took to the street, and they campaigned, and they said, no, we don't want you to run for a third term. And so they stopped him. And again, it's been civil society that's been pushing these drives in Zambia towards cleaning up the politicians and cleaning up society generally and trying to make it free of or as free of corruption as you possibly can. So I think that's something worth bearing in mind, the fact civil society in Africa has got a much louder and stronger voice nowadays.
Can I just come in on that? It's Martin
sure.
here. I mean, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, one of the things that's happening at the moment is that President Moi was trying to get his own choice as successor adopted in Kenya. And that way looks as if it's going to be blocked by the pressure from ordinary people. They're just fed up. They don't see why they should be pushed around by their politicians. And there was always this argument, there was an African way. There was a different way of dealing with these things. We have ways of reconciling things. This was the sort of language the leaders used to act against democratic organizations and against civil society. And frankly, it doesn't wash anymore. I think people are saying, we want to make our own minds up.
And I think if I could jump in, this is Rachel from Johannesburg, from the New York Times. I mean, I think they're all right on that. And I think sometimes what's lost in the enormous problems that countries and people of this continent face is that, you know, over the past 10, 12 years, there's been an enormous change on the continent in terms of democracy spreading, imperfectly, obviously. But when you go back to the 80s, like Martin was saying, you had people like Mobutu of Zaire who could say, democracy is not for Africa. That's hard to say now. And you do see in South Africa, we're spending talking about civil society. I was talking about AIDS being one of the biggest, being the biggest problem facing this region. It was ordinary people from a group called the Treatment Action Campaign that helped push the government to declare that it would offer treatment to prevent babies being born with HIV/AIDS. And it's here that you have the unions who are pressing the government to do more to alleviate poverty. And I think those are some of the most hopeful signs, because if ordinary people can press their governments and demand what they need, I think it's harder for leaders, bad leaders like President Mugabe, to be successful.
President Mugabe.
By my question, go ahead. I had one for Rachel, but go ahead.
Well, I was just going to make the comment that President Mugabe seems to be pretty effective in putting down any kind of movement by the people to protest.
He has been very successful. I mean, because he's arrested journalists, he's arrested opposition leaders. Most Western governments believe this last presidential election was rigged. And in some ways, it's an example of, I mean, and it's not that there aren't ordinary people and civil society who are not willing to stand up and say what is wrong. They are. But he has the power of the government machinery, and he's using it.
Right. Philip, go ahead.
I was just, because in North Africa at the moment, particularly with the war on terror, the U.S. is being harshly criticized for not supporting human rights. And, you know, in the last 20 years, they haven't really done the same work on promoting democracy in the Arab world that they've done in maybe the rest of Africa. So I wondered, down in South Africa, in the middle of Africa, whether the U.S. influence is seen as positive on civil society, because I would venture to guess that in general it's not seen as very positive in North Africa. That may be changing. It could change with this new decision to freeze aid for Egypt, but it will be a long process.
I think in Southern Africa, and this is Rachel again from Johannesburg, that there has been a lot of criticism. I mean, because, and not just Southern Africa, Angola, for instance, is a country where, it should be a rich country and because of all of its oil and diamonds. And there's been a great deal of corruption. Because of American interests in the oil industry there, there's a sense, a very strong sense among civil society in Angola that the United States has not been strong enough in cracking down and on corruption there and pushing for a more democratic system. And I can think of Eritrea also, which is kind of viewed as an ally in the war against terrorism, which, you know, has jailed journalists and critics. And again, a lot of people say that there has not been enough. So there are similarities elsewhere.
Can I just come in here? It's Martin in London. I mean, I think one of the issues that we have to bear in mind is the end of the Cold War in 89. I mean, when the confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States ended, it really made a huge change in Africa, because many African countries had been areas in which the two sides just fought their battles. I mean, Angola is a perfect case. It was United States came in on the side of South Africa, Cuba and the Soviet Union came in on the other side, and this was really the start of the Civil War. It certainly made it a great deal worse. In Ethiopia, you've got the same kind of confrontation. In Congo, you had the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba in the 1960s. So, I mean, you know, it was because of the Cold War and because of superpower intervention that many African countries got into the state that they're in now. Now that the Cold War is over, there's a possibility for both the United States and other countries in the world, including the Russians, to be involved in a much more positive way.
Yeah, but instead of that, what has happened is that Africa has, to some extent, become ignored, hasn't it, by the industrialized nations?
Well, that is true. But on the other hand, it's better to be ignored than to be trampled over by your armed soldiers.
That's correct. That's certainly the case. Martin, you were talking about the Sudan and changes in the Sudan, and that's something, frankly, that I knew nothing about. What about other problems in the Sudan? Its incursions into Uganda and what we call in this country the slavery situation in the Sudan. Is progress being made along those lines?
Well, this will be one of the issues that is being attempted to be sorted out in Kenya at the moment. It'll be a hard one to crack because some of these practices go back to, over hundreds of years, so it won't be easy to end. I mean, the question of slavery has always been somewhat exaggerated, but it does exist in the Sudan, there's no doubt about it. But I think the Sudan talks have been going perhaps better than people anticipated, and they are making progress. Again, here an American role has been very positive, actually. There's been quite an involvement. But I'd be interested to know from Philip what the view from Egypt is of the possibility of peace, because the Sudanese have always been, the Egyptians, as I remember, were always fairly wary of peace in the Sudan.
Yeah, Martin, I'm very sorry, but Philip is not going to be able to answer that question. We're out of time. Our guests today have been Rachel Swarns of the New York Times in Johannesburg, South Africa, Martin Plout of the BBC in London, Philip Smucker of the Christian Science Monitor and London Daily Telegraph in Cairo, and Penny Dale of the BBC in Lusaka, Zambia. Our director is Pat Akers and our producer, Sarah Andrea Fajardo. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie, global journalist. We'll be back next week.